All right, good morning. I think we're ready to get started. Welcome. My name is Eric Cadell. I am here today to introduce our panel on behalf of the Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Group, which I am not a member of, but also the International and National Security Law Group, which I am a member of. Our chair, Matthew Hyman, could not be here today, and he sends his regrets. Just a word about our group. We do cover a wide range of topics. Please take a look for our programming, just to give you a flavor of the kinds of things that we cover in addition to today's panel. We've had recent panels on Taiwan and the understanding of the military dynamic of a potential U.S.-China conflict, on the war powers, on the Abraham Accords, the expansion of export controls in order to secure U.S. technological leadership, especially in semiconductors, the situation in Ukraine, and the future of U.S. counterintelligence. So quite a wide range, and expect additional programming in the near future. Today, we're going to cover a subject that has been very much in the news since August of 2022, when the FBI executed a search warrant at Mar-a-Lago, the home of former President Trump. Since that time, it's come to light that documents, in addition to being held in President Trump's former residence, were also found in the residences of our current president and other locations. What we're focusing on is the legal side of the question. At the end of an administration, the president and the vice president are required to relinquish control over certain documents pursuant to the Presidential Records Act, and our expert panel today will explore the legal, ethical, national security, and policy issues that confront executive branch lawyers as they assist the president and the vice president to comply with the law. We have some expert panelists here today. My role is to introduce to you today the moderator, Judge Carl Nichols. He will introduce you to the rest of the panelists. Judge Nichols and I have known each other for, I don't even know, 20, 25 years probably or more. I followed him in clerking for the late Judge Silberman on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and then Justice Thomas. I think actually, Carl, you, Judge Nichols, you interviewed me for that position, so I'm kind of surprised I got it, maybe. But in any event, Judge Nichols has been in addition to his clerkship service, with the U.S. Justice Department from 2005 to 2009. And then he was a partner at Wilmer Hale here in Washington, D.C. from 2009 to 2019, when he was appointed to the bench to serve as district judge on the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. With that, I'll turn it over to Carl. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eric. I think we've known each other for probably 27 years, actually. Thank you for the introduction. Here today with a very distinguished panel who cover a wide variety of experiences relevant to the topics we're going to discuss today. I'll go from farthest away from me to closest, beginning with Elise Bean. She is the other thing I should know is we have three Michigan law panelists today. I think maybe the first time I've seen that. Elise graduated from Wesleyan University, then University of Michigan Law School. Following that, she clerked for the Chief Judge of the U.S. Claims Court and worked for 2 years at DOJ as well. Perhaps most importantly, as to our discussion today, from 1985 to 2014, she worked as an investigator for Senator Carl Levin, including for 15 years at the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, which many of you may know as the PSI, which is known for being a bipartisan, fact-based committee that investigates various complex issues, many of which end up hitting the front pages of the Journal and the Times and the like. She was appointed Senator Levin's PSI staff director and chief counsel in 2003, handled investigations, hearings, and legislation and the like. After Senator Levin retired in 2015, She helped establish the Levin Center for Oversight and Democracy, a nonprofit whose primary mission is to strengthen bipartisan oversight capacity in Congress and state legislatures. She now serves as co-director of the Levin Center's Washington, D.C. office. To her right is Alex Joel. Alex went to Princeton and then Michigan. He then served in the JAG Corps, worked as a law firm lawyer, and then, as particularly important today, spent a very many years in the Intel community. He worked in various roles, including in the Office of General Counsel at the CIA, and then for many years at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI, in various roles, including as the chief of the Office of Civil Liberties, Privacy, and Transparency, when he was the Civil Liberties Protection Officer. So Alex knows a lot about classification and declassification related issues. He is now a scholar in residence and adjunct professor at the Washington College of Law. And then immediately to my left is Steve Bradbury. Steve went to Stanford and then Michigan. He clerked for Judge Buckley on the DC Circuit before clerking for Justice Thomas. During the Bush 43 administration, Steve served in various capacities at the Office of Legal Counsel at DOJ. He was the head of that office from 2005 to 2009, advising the president and the executive branch on a wide range of constitutional and statutory issues, including, I believe, issues relating to the Presidential Records Act, but certainly classification issues as well. More recently, Steve served in the Trump administration as the Senate-confirmed General Counsel of the Department of Transportation. He also had other roles at Transportation. He has served as a partner, mostly in the litigation practice, I think, at both Kirkland and Dechert, and he is now a distinguished fellow at the Heritage Foundation. So thank you all for being here. I think your varied experiences will be very helpful to the discussion today. So it seemed to me that there are really three topics that we're going to cover their overlap on. One of them is the Presidential Records Act, of course, which Steve is going to give us a primer on. But the Presidential Records Act overlaps in some respects with questions around classification and declassification. And obviously, we're not going to talk about any specific cases or issues today, specific news stories. But obviously, as Eric said earlier, the press reports last year about the Mar-a-Lago search warrant it wasn't just about Presidential Records Act issues, but they're about classified documents. And so we're going to talk also not just about the Presidential Records Act generally, but about classification issues and declassification issues, overclassification issues, and the like. And then, because this is in part a panel sponsored by one of the committees that Eric identified, we're also going to talk about the rules or how lawyers should conduct themselves who are working on classification or Presidential Records Act issues. We'll probably cover that at the end. So just to give you a bit of a primer, I'm going to ask each of our panelists to do sort of a 5-minute overview of a topic relevant here, and then we'll get into my directed questions, then leave some time at the end. So Steve, if you could give us a 30,000-foot view of the Presidential Records Act to frame the rest of our conversation.
Great. Judge, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Happy to be here. In August 1974, right after President Nixon resigned, he pretty promptly entered into a contract with the General Services Administrator, somebody he had appointed. And this contract purported to give him the right to destroy the records of his presidency, including the tapes of conversations in the Oval Office. Congress immediately kicked into gear and passed legislation, which President Ford signed in December 1974. This was the Presidential Recordings and Materials Preservation Act. This is a precursor to the Presidential Records Act we have today. And what it did is it abrogated that contract that former President Nixon had entered into, and transferred title to all of his presidential records to the administrator of the of General Services. And it required the administrator to go through the materials and identify what was personal and return it to Richard Nixon, and maintain and preserve all the rest of the presidential records. It also, by its terms, respected any claims for executive privilege in those materials. So President Nixon challenged the law, and it went before a three-judge panel in Judge Nichols' court, the District of D.C., and the three-judge panel rejected his request for an injunction, and the Supreme Court upheld that 7-2, and the Supreme Court rejected, a majority of the Supreme Court, Justice Brennan writing, rejected separation of powers challenges, property interest challenges, First Amendment challenges, and Bill of Attainder challenges. The legislation actually referenced President Nixon personally. Then Associate Justice Rehnquist wrote a dissent in which he said, I think this will chill future president's staffs from the willingness to provide candid information if they know that all of the records are going to be maintained and subject to later review. Supreme Court rejected that because the review was going to be done within the executive branch, and he thought it was consistent with separation of powers. So now we have the Presidential Records Act, which was passed 4 years later, and sort of building on that foundation, what it does is it declares by statute that all presidential records, which are any kind of record that reflects the business of the president, that relates to the official duties of the president or has an effect on them, including ceremonial duties, are the property of the United States. Basically, it declares that the title in all presidential records is with the United States. It requires the incumbent president, while in office, to have systems in place to preserve all those presidential records, and it provides official role for the archivist of the United States, the head of the National Archives, to participate in the preservation and handling of presidential records. It requires that the records are transferred to the archivist upon the termination of the president's term in office, and it provides detailed requirements for restricting access to presidential records. At the end of the administration, before he leaves office, the president can identify a period of time for restricting access to certain categories, six categories of presidential records. Those are classified documents, properly classified under executive order, documents relating to the appointment of federal officials, documents that are exempt from disclosure by statute, documents that constitute trade secrets or confidential commercial information, documents that reflect deliberative advice given to the president or between presidential advisors, and documents that relate that involve personnel records or medical records that could be an invasion of privacy. And what the president does is he can say how long those categories are to be restricted from public access, up to 12 years. Any other records that don't fall into those categories are protected for up to 5 years. And after these periods of time run, then all these records are subject to FOIA because they become records of the National Archives and are treated like agency records and subject to FOIA. Except that the ordinary rules for agency records involving deliberative agency records are not, that B5 exemption to FOIA does not apply. And we can talk about what that might mean. Just to finish up on the Presidential Records Act, it has provisions that allow for members of the public, historians, et cetera, to ask for materials and for decisions to be made by the archivist as to whether the materials fall into the restricted categories. It provides for notice to the former president and the incumbent president. And then whenever the archivist is going to propose to make something public, it gives an opportunity for the former president and the incumbent president to ask for an assertion or to assert executive privilege and provisions for the resolution of that. It also provides access to Congress and access to others by court order to materials that are preserved. So let me wrap up there and we can get back to fleshing out some of the details of the statute.
Thank you, Steve. As you said, one of the categories that the PRA specifically gives the outgoing president a role in deciding how long to protect are classified records. Obviously, the White House has classified information, but so do other agencies and the entire executive branch, and Congress has access to classified records. Alex, could you give us, again, a 30,000-foot overview of, I guess, the classification world generally? Why is it that documents are classified? Under what authority? Where are they housed? How are they housed? How are they protected and the like? I know that's a big topic, but...
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Yes.
Yeah, it is a big topic. I'll try to be very quick. So the reason classified information exists, the whole system of classification is designed to protect information from public disclosure, the disclosure of which would harm national security. So it's really information that, if known more generally, would harm national security. And so you can think of a lot of different kinds of information that might fit within that. And then as you start thinking about how do you design a system to protect that when you have a large government with a lot of operations and activities, it becomes an enormous challenge. And the way the United States has done it is through executive order, the president signing out an order. And those of you who are separation of powers students and followers of all of those debates can imagine the back and forth in terms of who has the authority to do this. The courts have been fairly clear that it's the president's primary authority to protect information, the disclosure of which could harm national security, which is why the president is the one that signs these executive orders. And so right now we're under Executive Order 13526, which was signed in 2009. And just before we started, I was reminiscing with Steve about my recollection of what the hang-up was in trying to revise the prior executive order to this one. New presidents tend to revise and issue their own executive order. President Trump did not. President Biden, his administration has announced that they are looking at this executive order and trying to figure out how to update it. So basically the executive order, we all have heard of the different classification levels, right? It establishes that you can have top secret, secret, confidential, three levels of classification. There are certain kinds of information you can classify. There are certain kinds of information you cannot classify. You cannot classify information to conceal violation of law or to protect an individual or agency from public embarrassment, things like that. But you must classify information, the disclosure of which would harm national security. There are original classification authorities. It's kind of a complex scheme, but obviously the president, the vice president, heads of the Secretary of Defense, the Director of National Intelligence, the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, et cetera, have been designated as original classification authorities. But if you work at one of these agencies, you aren't the director, you are somebody working at that agency, and yet you are the one who's going to be generating mountains of information through email and through memo writing and everything else, and cables and everything else that intelligence agencies have to do. And so how do you decide what information you've just written a memo based on a meeting you attended, how is that supposed to be marked? Well, the order requires that you mark it appropriately and has something called derivative classification. So if you're gonna work at an intelligence agency, you are gonna be viewed as a derivative classifier. You are gonna be applying markings to documents you create and handle based on a guide that the agency produces and tells you, well, if this information could reveal the identity of a human source, it needs to be marked top secret, blah, 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 And so you therefore mark it accordingly. So the executive order very clearly says that information is not to remain classified forever and that it must be declassified when it no longer meets the standards for classification. So how does that happen? It lays out certain avenues for declassification. So there are, I'll just quickly say, there's an automatic declassification time frame, right? It typically is 10 to 25 years. Among the intelligence agencies, they tend to use 25 years. Well, now you go back 25 years in time and you start thinking about the onset of digital technology in all of our workspaces and all of our lives, you can start thinking about this huge amount of electronic data that's coming up on the 25-year automatic declassification mark. Now, of course, intelligence agencies would never agree to automatically declassify everything regardless of what happens, right? So they're going to want to take a look at that information. There are provisions for which by which they can extend the classification period. So that's automatic declassification. There's also something called mandatory declassification. If you know of a document, let's say a document's been released and it cites to a memo dated such and so from somebody, but it seems like it was a top secret memo, but it has not been released along with this document, you could submit a mandatory declassification review request for that document. If you identify the document, you can submit an MDR request, and then there's a process within the executive branch to review your request and determine whether or not that document can in fact be released. It's a very slow process, and it's obviously a manual process, but it does exist. So I'll just mention those as a couple. There's also something called public interest declassification, which as the former Civil Liberties Protection Officer, I was extremely interested in, which is in some extraordinary cases, you can declassify a document if it's in the public interest, even if it continues to meet the standards for classification. And that was the authority that was used following the Snowden disclosures to put out a large amount of information about how intelligence activities were conducted that were the subject of a huge amount of attention. And still are with, you know, we have FISA coming up for reauthorization, and there's a lot of information that could helpfully persuade those on the fence on what to do about it, about either the value or the problems associated with it. I think I'll stop there, and happy to dive in further on classified information.
We'll do that. So we talked about mostly about the executive branch. Obviously, Steve mentioned the fact that the PRA was passed by Congress, as was the earlier statute directed at President Nixon. But Elise, there are both other players involved, other branches, and some agencies that we've only mentioned in passing. So can you give folks sort of a overview of the relevant players, some of whom we haven't really talked about, but in particular the role of Congress in both the classification world and the Presidential Records Act world?
Sure, and thank you very much for inviting me to be on this panel. This is a complicated topic that goes in a lot of different directions, but here are just some of the key players in the process. First of all is the president, the original source of classification. They can also make an initial determination under the Presidential Records Act if something is a personal or presidential record. They can declassify documents. They can store both unclassified and classified documents, and they're required by law to turn over presidential records at the end of their term. They have a national security staff that helps them out. They provide the president with classified documents, they help track and store them, and they should document the declassification of any classified materials. There's also the White House lawyers. They can help categorize documents as personal or presidential records. They can help document any declassification that goes on. And they can help ensure that the records are turned over to the archives at the end of a president's term. Then there's the archivist in the National Archives. They are responsible under the law for obtaining and storing and preserving presidential records at the end of a president's term. If they find that some are missing, they're supposed to go out and get them. And they are also responsible for responding if there are requests for records. Okay, Department of Justice also gets involved. They help the National Archives if they have to go looking for missing documents. They can also help them to determine classification issues, and they can use, if necessary, the FBI to conduct a search. So then there's the current president. We've been talking about the president who is leaving term of office. Now we have a current president. As we just heard, presidential records are normally kept confidential for anywhere from 5 to 12 years after they leave office. But sometimes requests are made before that limit is up. There is procedure in the law itself where the archives gives notice to both the former president and the sitting president. The former president has 30 days to assert executive privilege. If they do, then the archives goes to the current president to see if they want to uphold the privilege. If the current president disagrees with the former president and waives the privilege because they feel it's in the interest of the United States, archives must produce those records then to the person who requested them within 60 days unless they receive a court order to the contrary. And that brings up the role of the courts. Courts have reviewed document disputes between former and sitting presidents on executive privilege. They typically, you know, gross generalization here, but defer to the sitting president. But there are issues that have come up about that in the courts recently. The courts have upheld the constitutionality of the Presidential Records Act. And finally, there's the role of Congress, and they play several different roles in this. First of all, they like to request documents from the archives. So they have a great interest in making sure that presidential records are transferred to the archives and that they are accessible to Congress. So that's their incentive. They want this law to work. They can also conduct oversight of issues related to the Presidential Records Act. For example, they can look at classification procedures, standards, systems. They can assess the national security risk if there are some missing records. They can look into the circumstances if the FBI does a search of a former president's property. And finally, of course, they can amend the Presidential Records Act if they feel there are some changes that should be made to make it work more effectively. So that's a big ecosystem around the Presidential Records Act, and it's part of the reason that we'll be talking about it today.
Elise, before I want to ask Alex a question about the discussion around over-classification. But could you just say a little bit about how Congress deals with classified information before I do that?
Well, so Congress has the right to see classified information. And there are many people on the Hill who that have authority to look at classified information. There is some dispute about whether Congress itself can either classify documents or declassify them. This is an area that has been, in various congressional investigations in the past, has been a very serious issue. So I don't know if you want me to go into more detail than that.
Why don't we see what we get to with Alex? So Alex, there's this debate about whether and to what extent we as a government over-classify documents. Where do you come out on that? Or perhaps what are the relevant considerations in thinking through whether we are in fact doing so?
So I don't think there's any question that there's over-classification, but I don't view that, but I think of that, it's important to think of that in a non-pejorative way, but rather just as a factual observation. So you will see instances where I could pull almost any document up and see that some of it is clearly unclassified, but yet has been marked as classified. And that is not, I don't ascribe malicious intent to that. That is human, that's natural human behavior. If you're working in a classified environment and you're seeing on a daily basis all of this information and it pertains to some intelligence operation or activity, there may be something in there that's innocuous and maybe you shouldn't have marked it classified, but your default is going to be, you know, I'm working on this stuff, it's pretty sensitive overall. I'm not going to spend time reading each and every paragraph and trying to think about it so carefully. I'm going to basically mark the whole thing classified. There was a famous email from CIA that was eventually released under FOIA. I think it was CIA, I can't remember the agency, but where they were passing around a menu, maybe it was for Taco Tuesday or something, and they had marked it secret. And so everybody mocked that. It's like, oh my God, you know, the CIA thinks that Taco Tuesday is secret. I'm not sure exactly what the menu said, but to me it was understandable. That's just normally, that's what they would mark their emails. And so they did that out of habit. So I think there's a lot of information that is going to be marked more conservatively than it should be on a more careful review. And that's what I try to tell people. I'm a transparency advocate, so I want more information to be out in the public, but you have to understand the problem that the government is dealing with. The most efficient way to protect classified information has been, the traditional thinking has been, I'm going to create the safe space, I'm going to put people in there who have clearance, I want them to mark the documents in a way that allows it to flow within the safe space but doesn't go outside. So it's all within the zone of silence, the cone of silence. And we can all talk to each other and it's great and we're being very efficient, but it's not going to go out. And then, but if I dip in and pull any of those documents out, I was like, this shouldn't be classified. So you have to come up with a system that allows the experts to work efficiently with each other in a way that they trust the information will not leak out. But then, but you also need the public to have better trust and ability to see what's going on within the government. So I think it's a difficult problem, but yes, objectively there are many more things marked classified than probably are merited.
Elise, you look like you want to say
I was just going to add a couple of examples of where this clash starts to happen in Congress in the past. So people may remember the Church Committee from the 1970s. That's when the Church Committee, which was a Senate committee from Congress, started looking into covert operations and found a lot of things that they found outrageous and made a lot of that information public. So that was a big dispute at the time about the extent to which they could make specific information public. Then a number of years later, and starting in 2004 and on, we heard about photographs surfaced of detainees in U.S. custody that had suffered abuse. And there were two different investigations, one by the Senate Armed Services Committee, one by the Senate Intelligence Committee, that wrote up reports about the information that they had found. The Senate Armed Services Committee went through a very lengthy declassification process where they ended up making their report public. The Senate Intelligence Committee, which I think had like a 6,000-page report, they went through a process to make the executive summary public, a declassified version of it, but the body of the report has never been made public. It's still classified. So those are the kinds of issues and Pentagon Papers. There was a whole dispute about whether Congress could simply put them in the congressional record and declassify it that way.
Thank you. Yeah, I remember those cases well. I litigated some of those detainee photograph cases. It seems to me that there is a, when you're talking, Alex, about the bubble or the cone, where you try to have a classified safe space, that is easier done at an agency than at the White House. The White House is, I've never worked at the White House, but my experience representing it is that it is, obviously there are people there who are dealing with highly classified information, but you have, it is both a consumer, in a sense, of classified information coming in from agencies. And you have people there who are dealing with a million things at once, some of which are classified and some are not. And so it is a ecosystem, to use a word, in which it's very difficult, or it's harder to maintain that bubble. And it seems to me that presents some unique challenges around protecting classified information. Do you agree with that generally? And if so, in your experience, do White Houses handle that challenge well?
So I also have never worked at the White House, but what you describe does sound like a very challenging environment. So one of the helpful things for, it's frustrating but also helpful, if you work in the intelligence community, you enter, it, when you go to work, it's all considered a vault, essentially. I mean, literally your office doors would, you know, some of them have some kind of combination lock on them. And so you are in a vault, and you know that in that space, that's where you can have your classified information, your classified discussions. When you go home, you should not be carrying with you any classified documents. So there's this sort of sharp dividing line between when you're at work in a classified environment, when you're not. If there isn't that sharp dividing line, it becomes much more difficult, I think. And if you're fluidly moving papers around and engaging with the public as well, I think it can be very challenging.
Right. So then, in my mind, Steve, it's not the most natural transition, but then there's the question of declassification and the president's authority to do so and the procedures, if any, that a president is required to go through to declassify, without talking about any particular president or set of documents. What are your thoughts around the authority question and the procedure question?
Thanks. Well, I think Elise kind of touched on the basis for classification and the sort of source of the power. I think she mentioned that it flows from the president. That's the fundamental point I think I would make. Gets into interesting issues when you talk about whether Congress has authority to declassify something that the executive branch has classified or to classify something. But fundamentally, as a constitutional matter, I would say the authority to classify information flows from the president. The president is the commander-in-chief. The president is the principal spokesman for the nation on matters of foreign policy. And classified information, national security information, focuses on the security of our military defense of our country and our interests and our relationships with our foreign allies. And that information from the very first presidency, George Washington, identified that information as critical for protection for the national interest. And he, from the beginning, asserted authority to protect it, to keep it confidential, and not to share it with Congress, even in response to requests for the specific materials from Congress. So that's sort of the in terms of the constitutional structure, it really flows from the president. But then we've, of course, created, we have a whole administrative state, a whole bureaucracy, multiple agencies created by Congress, administered and supervised by the president, that have lives of their own, and they exist, and they undertake duties, and have operations and responsibilities, and they need to handle classified information. Some of them generate it. The president delegates down to the heads of these departments and agencies the authority, to, as an original matter, to classify information. And they need to do it. Some of them deal with foreign allies. Some of them deal with intelligence information, military secrets, et cetera. But there's a bias in the bureaucracy to generate classified information and to maintain it as classified. And so presidents have really inclined toward pushing to declassify. They often have an interest in spreading information around. Congress has an interest. The president wants to respond to that. So the presidents have have signed executive orders that provide detailed procedures, as Alex described, for declassifying and trying to facilitate the declassification. You know, there's an inertia against doing that in the bureaucracy because nobody down in the bureaucracy wants to be the one who made the decision to declassify something that turns out to be critical to national security. But none of those documents, none of those procedures speak to the what the president has to do to declassify. And the president has a role in approving declassification. He's set up a structure for appeals and everything to do that. But because the authority flows from the president, as a matter of a constitutional analysis, the president has authority to declassify in his own right. And there's no necessary procedure he has to follow to do that. He can make an on-the-spot decision that this information, it's in the national interest to make it available to some other party that's not cleared to see it, or to the public, or to Congress. And he can do that on his own authority. But that leads to lots of difficult questions for the White House counsel and for others in the bureaucracy and others who are advisors to the president to be sure that that's documented, to be sure that it's known, to explain how and why it was done, so that all the other people who have a need to handle that information or those documents are protected against potential legal liability and whatnot. So, raises very interesting questions if a president on his way out the door makes a snap decision to declassify some important materials. How is that going to be documented? How is that going to be handled? What does that mean for other people around the president? And also, what's the proof of that if it comes to a case in court?
So perhaps stepping out of the, excuse me, the pure classification, perhaps declassified on the way out the door context, but there are the procedures in the statutes that we talked about requiring some robust preservation efforts around presidential records when there has been an election and a new president. And you just identified the White House counsel as having a very important role in maintaining records around classification issues, but more generally, the counsel's office is very critical to PRA efforts.
Yes.
And one of the topics we're discussing today is the role of executive branch lawyers in ensuring compliance with the PRA. So can you talk a little bit about what the role of the lawyers is, and in particular the role of the counsel's office is?
It's critical. It's a critical role. Working with the archivist from day one of a new administration, the White House counsel really needs to ensure that all of the many characters who work in the White House complex, who come in and out, participate sometimes for very short periods of time, sometimes for the entire administration, in advising and assisting the president, understand the strict requirements of the Presidential Records Act, understand that their communications, the documents they create, the chats they may send, even the WhatsApp messages they may send that relate to the work, the tweets, the draft tweets, all of it that relates to the work of the president and the White House is not their property. Those are not only their private communications. Those are the property of the United States. So the White House counsel really, from day one, has to try to educate and repeatedly educate, and I would say take an affirmative role in ensuring that systems are in place, that people understand the requirements. Every time a record is created in the White House, there has to be a classification decision made as to whether it's a presidential record or a personal record. They need to be filed separately. And there are usually systems in place to get the presidential records into an archive that's maintained by the National Archive, even during the president's term in office. Now, the president maintains control and custody over those records during his term in office, but there are record filing systems to get those into the right archives to help so you don't have a utter chaos at the end of the administration when everything in a big dump goes to the archives. But you have to have those systems in place. White House counsel is one of the main actors to ensure that. And these days, critical issue is the use of personal email, personal smartphone devices, and these apps and other things where there's a mixture of official business and personal business. And that is the number one issue the White House counsel has to work on and police. There's a provision of the Presidential Records Act, Section 2209, the last section in the act, requiring that all these advisors in the White House, and actually the president and the vice president themselves, are not supposed to use personal communications devices or personal accounts to communicate, and if they do, they're supposed to copy their official account or provide a copy within 20 days to their official account. That's already kind of obsolete. That's old technology even right there. Right now, people are using these apps, and some of these apps delete the message as soon as it's sent. And so probably there's a need to reconsider and amend the statute to keep it up to date, but the White House counsel's got his or her arms full, ensuring that those lines are maintained. There is a discipline. There's the liability of disciplinary action required for employees in the White House complex who violate that stricture, and then there's also criminal liability under 18 U.S.C. 2071 for anyone who removes official presidential records from the White House and takes them removes them from the White House or conceals them. And that liability potentially does even reach the president, so the former president. So White House counsel got a critical role in ensuring that these requirements are met and that liability does not come into play.
I want to ask Elise in a second about the role of Congress and lawyers at Congress, and then perhaps some efforts that can be and have been taken in certain cases to try to get documents that perhaps weren't turned over. But can you also just say a little bit, Steve, about the role of the lawyers at NARA and DOJ working with the counsel's office on these issues?
Yes. So most primarily when there's requests to NARA to disclose information that's either restricted or even information past the date of a special restriction under FOIA, the material before there's notification given to the former president, whose documents these are, and to the current president, that NARA is about to disclose material. And NARA works with Office of Legal Counsel at DOJ and White House counsel if either the former president or the incumbent wants to assert executive privilege over those materials. And there's a close working relationship there. And there's also a close working relationship all the way along, really, through the presidential term to help educate people in the White House. NARA comes over, they give presentations, et cetera, and then organizing the materials and as they go over over to NARA. But once they go over to NARA and NARA's in the process of processing them, that doesn't mean the issues end. I mean, that's really only the beginning in a lot of respects, because requests come in because it's really the archivist that makes the decision. I mentioned those six categories where the president can identify a length of time for restricted access, but the president doesn't identify which documents fall into those categories. It's actually the archivist who goes through the process of identifying which documents fall into those categories. And if, number one, if the requester doesn't agree, doesn't like NARA's conclusion that the documents are restricted, there's an internal appeal process, but no judicial review of NARA's decision. If NARA decides they're going to be disclosed and the former president doesn't like that decision, the former president can actually go to Judge Nichols's court in a special action to try to prevent the archivist from producing them. Lawyers are involved in all of these questions, and there's close collaboration, or at least input, between the archivist and the archivist's lawyers and the Office of Legal Counsel at DOJ for the Attorney General and the White House Counsel.
So, Elise, we've been talking about a couple of different issues, one of which is documents that have made their way to NARA that are asserted to be privileged or otherwise protected. But there are documents that maybe don't make their way to NARA for whatever reason. Perhaps someone was using a personal email or an app and didn't adequately preserve those documents, or takes the position that they aren't government property or something else. So for people who are no longer at least executive branch employees, what tools does the government, and I'll put the government generally, either the executive branch or Congress have if there's an effort or a desire to try to get those documents produced to NARA?
Well, when I was hearing Steve talk about how the White House counsel's arms are full trying to deal with this issue, and he sure is right. A recent case that went through the D.C. District and Circuit Courts involved a former White House official, Peter Navarro, who used a Proton Mail account that had both, as you said, personal and official emails. He identified about 250 emails that arguably were involving his work for the White House, but he declared they were his personal emails and he wasn't going to turn them over. And I think it's actually the first case where the Department of Justice went to court and used a D.C. Replevin law to say those documents belong to the United States. He's got them. We should get them. And Mr. Navarro responded, there is no enforcement mechanism in the Presidential Records Act itself, so you're out of luck and I'm not turning them over. Well, the courts agreed with the Department of Justice. We haven't had too many cases where a White House official is saying, no, I had these documents that had to do with my work, but I'm not turning them over. So that's one tool that people have used. Another way that Congress gets involved, as I mentioned earlier, is they just want to make a request for documents that should be with the archives. And the one recent example of that is the January 6th committee, which asked the archives for a number of presidential records. In accordance with the law, the archives notified the former president. He asserted executive privilege. The sitting president said, well, there may or may not be executive privilege, but I'm going to waive any privilege that exists because I believe it's in the interest of the United States in this very unusual set of circumstances involving the attack on the U.S. Capitol. And went to court, and we had the district court, circuit court, and the Supreme Court all got involved. and they went along with the sitting president to allow these documents to be disclosed to Congress. But they all emphasized that this was very unusual circumstances, that the former president didn't have a really good argument about why they should be privileged or, you know, kept confidential. And one of the Supreme Court justices, Justice Kavanaugh, made a specific point of saying, you know, I disagree that the sitting president's opinion always wins and that we should defer to the decision of the sitting president. A former president under certain circumstances could have an equally forceful argument. So the law is not resolved, but that's another mechanism that Congress uses to actually make this request to the archives. And then finally, what I'll mention is we had this whole situation where classified materials were found at the residence of two former presidents and a former vice president as well. And Congress wanted to know what those documents were because they wanted to do a national security risk analysis. The executive branch resisted and said, that's up to us. It's not really up to you, Congress. But the Senate and House Intelligence Committees insisted on a bipartisan basis. And some of those documents have now been turned over. And that process is now going on where the Congress itself is taking a look at the classified materials and trying to determine what the national security risk really is. So those are some ways that Congress can get involved and the kinds of tools that can happen both when documents aren't turned over and when they are.
Thank you. Alex, we've been talking about Presidential Records Act, but to go back to the classification question, can you talk a little bit about the role of the lawyer in, at least in an agency that has a significant amount of classification information, and the role of the lawyer in at that agency in making classification decisions, protecting classification, classified information and the like?
Sure. And as a lawyer, I can say that the role of lawyers is absolutely essential. Can never have too many lawyers. But seriously, when you think about our democracy and our system of government, so much of it depends on the assumption that you will have access to information, right? So if you have an adversarial process in a court, you've got discovery, you know, you assume that you will have access to information in order to make your case. If you are going to be tried for a crime, of course you need to have access to information. We have the Freedom of Information Act, the Privacy Act. These are statutes that, at their core, assume that there will be access to information. So our legal system is premised, in any democracy, is premised on this idea that you will have the ability to get information you need to vindicate your rights or to check to see that the law has been followed. And yet we have a system, every country has a system that by necessity, protects classified information from disclosure. So it creates this tension, and lawyers are essential to managing that tension. Because I always say that a democracy must have, its legal framework must do two things at the same time and be equally good at both. It must enable agencies to protect the nation's security, which includes secrecy, but it also must protect people's privacy and civil liberties. It must prevent those agencies from themselves becoming a risk to the democracy that they're sworn to protect. And so lawyers are fundamental to managing this tension, and it plays itself out in so many ways. So making sure the executive order is being followed properly, that things aren't being marked classified to avoid, to conceal violations of law. It's used to manage the declassification, they get involved in managing the declassification process and the review processes under the executive order. The Freedom of Information Act obviously has an exemption for classified information. There's litigation under the Freedom of Information Act that continues to evolve that obviously lawyers have to be intimately part of. When there are private litigation, there's something called the state secrets privilege, which is based on classified information. So lawyers have to be involved in making sure that the state secrets privilege is properly being asserted and applied. And there are all kinds of processes for doing that. Agency lawyers work very closely with the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice obviously is the lead on assertion of state secrets privilege and those kinds of things, but they rely on agency lawyers to do a lot of the underlying work and analysis for, you know, the agency's particular equities. And it goes on and on. I mean, I mentioned previously the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Section 702, being up for reauthorization. This is a key legal authority. Lawyers are all intimately involved in figuring out what information can and should be made available to the public in support of the debate for deciding whether that law should be reauthorized. And mentioning the Church Committee, one little known finding of the Church Committee was that agencies should have more lawyers, and they now do. So that recommendation was implemented.
So I'm going to turn it over to the audience for questions in 1 second, and I'll make one last comment, which is about the state secrets privilege, because I think it's a place where the role of the lawyer is particularly important and unique. State secrets privilege, as many of the folks know here, I'm sure, is asserted by the executive branch in litigation where the litigation would requires the production of information that, if produced, would harm national security. And the assertion of the state secrets privilege must be done by the head of the department that has the information. That is, obviously, if the information is a non-DOJ agency, it's going to be the head of the department, the director of national intelligence, the head of the CIA, through a signed declaration. And in my experience, when the head of a department is signing a declaration asserting the state secrets privilege, every lawyer in sort of the chain is working on it and is thinking very hard about whether it's appropriate to assert the privilege, of course, whether the declaration is completely true and the like. And at the same time, DOJ is involved because DOJ is the litigating entity, obviously, for the executive branch. And so if the information is CIA information, not only does the director of the CIA have to be willing to assert the privilege with the assistance and advice of the counsel there, DOJ has to be willing to advocate for the assertion of the privilege. And in my experience, the assertion of the privilege by DOJ goes up to the highest levels, briefing to the Attorney General, the DAG, the associate. And so in that world, lawyers play a critical role at multiple agencies, ensuring that there isn't an over use of the privilege, that it's appropriate and the like, and that everyone has thought about all the implications you've identified, because not only in the state secrets privilege are you protecting the information, but typically the result of the assertion is dismissal of a suit. So someone who might actually have a potentially viable claim, that suit is dismissed by the mere implication of the privilege.
If I could just piggyback on that, and that's one reason why, in my experience talking to agency lawyers who work on the privilege issues, they are very careful, and people are cognizant that overuse or perceived overuse of the privilege puts it at risk. Even though it's a privilege that's been identified by the Supreme Court, you still put pressure on it if it's clear in some situations that it should not have been asserted. And so people are, in my experience, very careful.
Yes, I agree. Okay. Anyone in the audience have a question? Happy to hear from anyone. Please. There are microphones so everyone can hear you, and it can be picked up in the live feed.
Yeah, thank you all for speaking. This has been really wonderful.
Your microphone might have a button on it.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Is it on?
Yes.
Wonderful. There we go. Thank you all. I'm Brady Marsden, first year at Georgetown Law. This has been really wonderful. It seems like there's been a bipartisan issue between admins of leaks coming out across different departments. How does that fit in to this conversation? Is there any remedy to that issue that's now spanned multiple administrations? Thank you.
There's even an interesting question about what's the line between a leaker and a whistleblower? Alex, you want to tackle this one first?
Sure. Yes, leaks are a perennial issue, and obviously we've had a very public one, and there's still reporting coming out about it, and it you know, obviously on something very current and damaging. So it brings up so many different thoughts, but I'll try to just limit it to a couple. One is this particular, the latest leak that's been in the news, brings to mind some of the early challenges and debates that we had within the intelligence community following 9/11, which was to it contrasts between the traditional view of classified information, which is that you share it on a need-to-know basis. I mean, that's in the executive order. You need to know. But on the other hand, following 9/11, where there was a huge emphasis on connecting dots and agencies not sharing with each other, we worked extremely hard to find ways to share information, and became also there was a contrasting saying, there's need to know, but there's also responsibility to provide. Particularly to the military, particularly to help them prepare for military operations or support their military activities. So you have these contrasting desires to make sure that everybody has access to the information without having to go through unnecessary gates, but then also being worried about if too many people have access to the information could be released in a harmful way. And from a privacy perspective, the more people know information, the less private it is. So there's also a concern around privacy there. And I don't think they've found, you know, it's not, I don't think you should view this as, you know, once you achieve the balance is always great. We've done, we're closed the door, we move on. It's constantly, it's a constant motion back and forth between, oh, we dialed it back too far here, oh, we need to dial it further this way. I think the world is always going to be, our government will always be seeking to find the right equilibrium point, and it will change over time. And, you know, so right now I know DOD is doing a review trying to figure out if they need to dial back on some of the of their processes that made that information available. And it is a bipartisan, nonpartisan issue. It happens across administrations.
Elise, let me perhaps ask a difficult or, I don't know, hot question, which is, would there be fewer leaks if we had stronger or better whistleblower protections or laws?
Well, as you said, there's a fine line between a leak and a disclosure by a whistleblower. There are a lot of whistleblower protections now that say if you're disclosing something that shows government misconduct or a violation of law, that's not a leak, that's a whistleblower, you know, disclosing the truth of the facts of what's going on. If we had stronger whistleblower protections, would there be fewer leaks? I guess the leaks are unauthorized, but a lot of people would say when a whistleblower gives something to Congress or to the press, it's also unauthorized. There are a lot of pressures on whistleblowers. Whistleblowers can be a two-edged sword for Congress. You have a person often who has been, or they feel that they've been mistreated by a government agency, and they often have an agenda, and you can't trust everything they say, and even if they truly believe and are giving you all the information as they understand it, they only know a certain piece of the pie, and they don't know what they don't know. So with whistleblowers, we always had to do a lot of double checking to see if their information was authentic and how it fit in with everything else. I think there should be stronger protections for whistleblowers, particularly with respect to classified information. That's sort of where we're weakest. But, you know, leaks, this town is just built on them. Congressional oversight loves them. And so unauthorized disclosures, and sometimes it has nothing to do with classified information. We got a leak from an accounting firm that disclosed all kinds of tax shenanigans going on by the accounting firm itself, KPMG. And we had a whole hearing just on that, on how they were manufacturing tax shelters. So no classified information there, but when the people gave us the information from within the firm, we're like, obviously they had just taken it from the firm. I don't think they had authority to do it, and we had a serious discussion about, can we use this information? We determined that we could since we didn't tell them to do it. But as you said, there are very difficult issues here.
I'm sorry, I forgot, Judge Nichols, that part of your question. And just to piggyback on this whistleblower issue, it's really important to understand in the intelligence community, whistleblowing does not equate with going public about something. So when you blow the whistle, it's very clearly defined that you have to go through the inspector general, the head of the agency, to Congress. That is the channel through authorized channels that protect classified information. But to your point, if somebody is feels that they've uncovered illegality or something that really must be seen, it's so important for the agency to protect that person from retaliation and to encourage that person to use authorized channels and to take that complaint seriously. So certainly when I was a Civil Liberties Protection Officer, we took those complaints very seriously. We investigated them carefully, and we didn't want the person to feel frustrated that the system wasn't listening to them. And that can also include transparency. So sometimes the action is legal, but the person is still upset, and they think the public should know. And that's why it's important to understand these mandatory declassification review channels, public interest declassification. Is there a way to be more public about something?
Steve, what do you think on these topics?
Well, I strongly agree with Elise in her point that so-called whistleblowers are often independent or free agents and those who rely on them shouldn't assume they are controllable. And in my experience, often when a whistleblower is communicating with an IG or with a committee of Congress, for example, by email, don't be surprised if the whistleblower is BCCing a reporter at a major newspaper. A lot of the whistleblowers have strong egos, and they have, as Elise said, their own agendas. Alex made the point that there's a process for whistleblowers to go through, first the IG, then the head of the agency, then Congress. So I would question, how often does a whistleblower make that stop at the head of the agency? I think there's a lot of instances where that little part of it is circumvented. And Congress has an interest in getting information, and so they make it easier and easier for whistleblowers to disclose to Congress and get protection without stopping at the up the chain to their ultimate supervisor, the head of the agency. But in a lot of cases, that whistleblower is actually pursuing his own agenda and sometimes has communications that you don't know with whom all this information is being communicated. When it's classified information, those disclosures can be criminal.
Could ask another question of the panelists on this topic, but I wanted to make sure that anyone who might have a question from the audience could ask one. Please, sir.
Thanks, Charles Keckler. Just a quick question. So I'm thinking back my own sort of government service, obviously not the president, but you know, when I would get the sort of mix of personal material as well as official material, you know, of course, we try not to have any personal material enter into the government account and so on. But to the extent that that ever happened, right, I would immediately remove it into a personal folder, right? Because, of course, as a regular government official, my materials were FOIA-able immediately. And so anybody could just ask what I'd done yesterday, and they'd come and try to get it. So I'm curious whether what people's thoughts are about with the distinction between personal and presidential records, to make it a, as we do with classification, to classify that something in a very sort of more deliberate way as personal. It gets stamped personal immediately. And so if you want to not make it personal, then that has to be, in effect, depersonalized or declassified in that way. And that sort of very sort of systematic way that it has to happen. And you know, sort of related to that, you know, if we have this system, as you brought up, where if you're using personal accounts and the government business happens on it, then you know you're supposed to copy it. You're supposed to bring it in to your official records. But maybe that default is wrong. If you're regularly using some particular account for government business, unless you classify it as personal, and you know that you're using this system, everything's assumed to be no longer personal. And so I'm just curious what people, this is sort of reform ideas, but I'm thinking about what people are thinking about it. Thank you.
Steve, you want to take a crack at that first?
Sure. So what the Presidential Records Act requires is that when any record is created, it's supposed to, a decision is supposed to be made as to whether it's personal or presidential record. And this is, you know, think of somebody who works in the White House complex involved in assisting the president. And White House counsel should give clear directions to ensure that that happens on a in a formal way. You can't police that every day, everywhere, every office. And so there will inevitably be circumstances where there's an intermingling or some personal records are created that are not classified or stamped in the right way. And I don't think you can have the kind of flipping of the default that you describe and assume that it's all presidential records when in fact they are personal and they don't relate to the president's business. I mean, the personal interest still is retained in those records. And what was the second
question? Well, I mean, they're related. Are you talking mostly about the president's personal versus the president's presidential records? What if you're talking instead about, say, the deputy counsel to the president,
yeah,
who is obviously engaged in a lot of official business but might be receiving emails from his or her kid at college or something,
yeah,
like that? Is the same concern present?
Oh, for sure. You know, everybody has personal lives, and so the concern is there, and it's respected. But even for the president can keep a personal diary, and if the personal diary is not circulated or made reference to or used in policymaking or something, it's still personal. And it's
to refine the proposal a little bit, what about a universe in which, at least for certain senior officials at the White House, the records are deemed Presidential Records Act records unless there's an affirmative decision to pull them out? Like the presumption flip, but not even, they are presidential records unless a step is taken to effectively classify them as non.
Yeah, well, I think even if that were followed, those materials which are clearly on their face personal would go over to the National Archives. The archivist would identify those as personal. And I think those would probably be destroyed or returned to the people whose interest was there. I don't think you can just by a presumption extinguish people's personal interests in their truly personal records. I do remember the second part of the question I just want to address, and that's the use of these other systems, personal devices, and whatnot. The statute is pretty clear that you're not supposed to do that and gives you limited circumstances, but everybody sort of thinks in their mind, oh, I can do that as long as I copy my email account, my official account, or in 20 days, you know, send a copy to it or something. But that's not the way the White House counsel approaches it. This is such an area for potential abuse and misuse. The White House counsel, typically, when they send a memo around to everybody in the White House complex, will be very stern and direct that you're not to use any personal devices, personal email accounts, personal apps, etc., for conducting business. And only in extreme emergency situations where you cannot get access to your account can you do it, but then you got to immediately blah, blah, blah. So they really try to prohibit it. Because otherwise it just gets out of control really quickly, and the potential for abuse, and this is only going to grow with new kinds of communication sources, as we saw in the case with Navarro.
If I could reinforce what Steve was saying, I mean, I worked for Congress for 30 years. I worked pretty much around the clock. I didn't even have a personal email, so all my personal stuff was on the Senate server because I was just always working. That's just the way it was. Congress, in virtually every investigation I ever did, we would come across truly personal emails, and Congress really never had any interest in those. You know, you're picking up your kid, somebody's sick, whatever. You know, so I agree with you that it doesn't lose its personal character no matter what, even if you sent it to the archives, and that's the way it should be.
I know we're just about out of time, but Alex, I wanted to ask one question for you about really in the classified world. It's been a while since I worked in the executive branch and with classified information, but at the time at least, you had entire systems that are classified only, email systems that are only classified emails, servers that are only classified, and it always seemed to me that one benefit of those systems was you weren't ever going to be sending an unclassified or personal email over those systems. Is that still the case, or is there a commingling risk even within those, what we used to call high side servers or email systems?
We still call them high side. So just to be clear, though, on the high side, you can send all kinds of unclassified stuff. It's supposed to be official business, but you are allowed incidental personal use of equipment. They don't really distinguish high side and low side in that sense. But the high side would be much less likely. It should not have your personal communications, obviously, with your family, because they're not. You would use a low side system, and many people have low side access because they have to. They have to do internet research. The other thing I'll just say in response to the question about marking is that that's the same issue that comes up with classified information. And the marking is just that, it's a marking, and it's gonna eventually have to be reviewed by somebody. So even if you mark something personal, it's still subject to review, and somebody could say, well, this was not marked correctly. Like, you can't just mark something and then forget it. You have to, it's gonna be reviewed by somebody at some point.
Thank you. Thank you for the questions. And I want to thank the panelists for this conversation today. I really appreciate the insights, especially given your varied backgrounds. So let's give a round of applause to the three of them.